Professor Butterworth, you argue that our brains are hardwired for numbers, that the average Westerner processes more than 10,000 numbers a day, for example. Why then do so many of us say we're rubbish at maths?
There are lots of reasons why we say that. One reason is that some of us are rubbish at maths. Another is that it's not regarded as being socially unacceptable to be rubbish at maths. But in other countries, I mean, for example, in China or in France or in the Middle East, being bad at maths is a serious stigma.
Why is it then that you argue that we are hardwired for maths?
Well, most of us are. In our genome, there are genes, we don't know which ones they are yet, that build circuits in the brain which are specific for numbers. If you look at twin studies, for example, there was a large twin study in the UK which found that something like 30% of the genetic variance in the population has got to do with maths ability and maths disability. If you look at families, if one of the family members has serious problems with maths, then it's 15 times more likely that somebody else in the family will have a serious problem. So it does look as though there's a heritable component to this. The other reason that's become clear in maybe the last 10, 15 years is that there are lots of other species that seem to have an ability for math. So at least some of the genes that build these brain circuits are probably very ancient, in the same way that some of the genes that go into timing, for example, are extremely ancient, conserved from the time we split off from the fruit fly, because they've got some of the same timing genes as we do. We don't know which genes they are for numbers, though we do know which ones they are for timing. So it's not surprising that we've got a special sensitivity to numerical information in the environment. In fact, you might draw an analogy with colour. So most of us have a sensitivity to colours in the environment. It's not always the same sensitivity, and some of us don't. So the genes that control the building of circuits in the eye and brain for colour sometimes don't work, so you get colour blindness of different types. So it's not surprising that something that's as important for many species as number has a heritable component.
Is there a circuitry in the brain designed for handling numbers, do you think, or does the brain co-opt circuits designed for other things when we do maths?
That's a very good question. It's certainly thought that for reading, which other species don't do, we do co-opt circuits for recognising visual shapes, obviously, and we tag that on to the circuits that have evolved for language. With number, there seem to be specialised circuits, at least for very simple number tasks, in a part of the brain called the parietal lobe, just above and behind the ear on both sides of the brain. So we don't think they're co-opted. We think that they're there from the start for that purpose. And we know quite a bit about them, actually, now. I mean, we know in humans that these circuits are active when you're doing number tasks. Almost any number task, you'll find these circuits in the parietal lobes active. But there's been some very interesting work done by Andreas Schneider in Tübingen with macaque monkeys. And he's been recording from single cells in the monkey brain. And he finds that in particular part of the parietal lobe, there are cells that respond to particular numbers. So there's a cell that responds to fourness in the environment, another cell that responds to threeness, up to about fiveness. So there does seem to be this specialisation. In fact, there's some other monkey work in the United States, covered up by Michael Platt and his colleagues, in which there are cells quite near the ones that Nida's discovered, which fire more the more things there are in the environment. So it looks as though there are two types of cell, nerve cell, in the brain that do these basic number tasks, and they're connected in some way, though it's not exactly clear how they're connected yet, but I'm sure we'll find out in the very near future.
So let's look at, first of all, what happens in the brain when it's processing individual numbers, if you like. Like I have two eyes or I weigh 50 kilos. How do we process numbers on that individual level?
We know that there seems to be a particular response of the brain to individual numbers, the human brain. Now, of course, we can't do single-cell recordings in human brains, but we can use what are called pattern classifiers, and there's some brilliant work being done in France at the moment by Stanislas Dehaene and his group, in which he's found that particular numbers elicit a particular pattern of activity in the parietal lobes. So we think that this is the basis of knowing that there are two eyes or three cups of tea or whatever. It's quite a complicated set of processes because you have to, first of all, identify that there are particular objects in the environment. We've actually done some work here in London showing that when there are objects in the environment that you need to attend to, you get a particular response in the brain. This information is then passed forward to the parietal lobes, which, if you like, counts the number of objects that you're paying attention to. If it's seeing a digit, for example, or hearing a number word like the word five, then it's a different set of processes, but they end up in the same place in the parietal lobe, so that there's a part of the brain called the fusiform gyrus in the temporal lobe that recognizes digits and will recognize written words like F-I-V-E for five. That information then gets passed on to the parietal lobe, where, if you like, the magnitude of the number that's being referred to is activated.
That moves us on, of course, to interactions between numbers, maths and arithmetic. How does the brain then do the job of adding, subtracting, dividing and multiplying? Is that also happening in the parietal lobe?
This is a very embarrassing question for us scientists, because, to be honest, we don't really know. What we do know is that when you're doing calculations, you recruit other brain areas to do it. So it's not just the little bit of the parietal lobe that responds to fiveness. So if you're just retrieving a number fact, like, for example, 5 + 3 = 8, then you recruit another part of the brain, actually also in the parietal lobe, called the angular gyrus. And this seems to channel information about learnt arithmetical facts into the other areas of the brain that you need to use to do whatever the task is, like answer the question. For things that are a bit more complicated than just retrieving simple number facts, you also need to recruit the frontal lobes. This is a part of the brain where you set up problems and goals that you need to solve right away. And so the frontal lobe will say, I need some information about the magnitude of the numbers that I'm dealing with, and do we have any facts about those numbers that I can use in order to solve the current task?
Now, you've been doing some interesting work on whether we need counting words. We were talking earlier about processing individual digits or individual words like the word five. Do we need a language of maths in order to handle and process numbers, to have numeracy?
There's actually been some research carried out in Amazonia which suggests that number words are critical for getting a sense of exactly fiveness, exactly tenness, exactly twentiness. So if you don't have a word for it, you can't have the concept. The work that we've been doing in Australia with Robert Reeve and Fiona Reynolds at Melbourne University with two Aboriginal groups suggests that this isn't true, that they're perfectly capable of identifying the number of objects in a display and of mentally manipulating them. So, for example, you can show five objects, cover them up, add some more objects to that set, and require an addition or a subtraction by taking objects away. You have to do all this mentally, and they have no more problem doing these than do people who've been brought up in an English-speaking environment in Melbourne.
These are communities in Indigenous Australia who don't have counting words.
That's right. Many, perhaps most, Australian languages don't have counting words and don't have counting practices. Some of them in Arnhem Land, which have traded for centuries with people from Indonesia, they may have borrowed some counting words from these other languages, but most Australian languages don't have them. Some of them will have words for 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, but it's not clear that they ever use them actually for counting. They might refer to five objects, or they might refer to four objects, but they don't go 1, 2, 3, 4, whereas children in Melbourne or London, they will be getting number words from birth pretty well, because lots and lots of games that we play with kids involve number words, involve counting. Nearly half of all nursery rhymes involve counting words, 1, 2, buckle my shoe, 3, 4, knock on the door, and so on. So they get a lot of very early experience in a numerate society like ours with number words, which they don't get in remote parts of Australia.
What did that research have to say about how our brains have evolved to handle numbers and mathematics?
What our research suggests is that all our brains, with a very small percentage of exceptions, are much the same, and that developing sophisticated arithmetical skills depends on the environment in which you live. So if you get taught how to do maths, then obviously that's going to help you develop ideas of maths. And you have to realise that in the history of even England, widespread arithmetical abilities is very, very recent indeed. I mean, people had great difficulty adding and subtracting even as late as the 16th century in England. Merchants in England or Germany would send their children to Italy, where they were much more advanced in mathematics, particularly in bookkeeping, in order to learn how to keep the books. So most of what we just take for granted now would not be known by people in the 16th century and probably wouldn't be known by most people in even the 19th century.
Because in certain circumstances, of course, you don't need many more words for numbers than one, two, a few, and lots.
That's right. What drove the development of writing numbers down, which happened first in Sumeria in the Middle East about 10,000 years ago, was trade. Particularly if you're trading at a distance, you need to keep a record of the stuff that you've sent your trading partner, and they need to know that they're getting the right number of objects that you've sent them. So if you want to send them 10 sheep, you have to make a note of how many sheep you're sending them, and they have to say, oh yes, well, I have received 10 sheep. So you need to be able to actually to symbolize the numbers when you're trading. So that's what really drove the development of arithmetic 10,000 years ago.
Your work has also looked at maths prodigies. Is there something special about their brains, the way that they're wired, or is it more complex than that?
Yeah, we have looked at calculating prodigies. The problem is it's very difficult to compare their brains with brains of other people. There are two reasons for this. One is there aren't very many of them, certainly not very many that have been studied so far. Secondly, everybody's brain is different, so you have to see what similarities and differences there are between them and some kind of control sample. That's very difficult to do. A little bit of work has been done on one German calculating prodigy called Rudiger Gam, done by a group in Belgium. And what they found was that Gam has recruited parts of the brain that we use for long-term memory and for visualization in order to do the kinds of calculations I personally couldn't possibly do, like finding the ninth root of a large number or finding the ninth power of a large number. But Gam can do this, and he does it using parts of the brain that we would use for something else.
Now, one of the observations that you've made about maths prodigies is that there is an interest in maths from an early age, that it's something that these people enjoy from childhood, and that that has an effect on the way that the brain develops its neuroplasticity. And you studied a 19th century Indian mathematician called Ramanujan, a man who had almost no formal training in mathematics, but whose work led to comparisons with Newton and Archimedes. So how was that possible for him?
Well, in the case of Ramanujan, whose brain we know nothing about, there were some similarities in his particular abilities to that of other prodigies, which is he spent most of his time doing maths. It's not true to say he had no training. He went to school, he went to high school, he could have got on to university had he taken the trouble to learn anything other than maths and take exams in it. But he was obsessed by maths, and even when he had a job, he'd get up 4 o'clock in the morning and do some maths before he went to work, and then he'd come home and his wife would feed him and do more maths. And he was obsessed by it, and most people who are really good at anything are actually obsessed by what they turn out to be good at. So if you take the case of Gam, for example, I was talking about before, he didn't really start doing any serious calculation until he was about in his 20s. Then he just decided that this is something he was going to be very, very good at, and he just practiced hours and hours every day. And this is what's in common with all calculating prodigies, is they spend an awful lot of time learning lots of mathematic facts, developing tricks for doing calculation. You might compare it to juggling. Anybody can juggle if they're prepared to put the time in, but not everybody thinks it's worth putting the time in order to learn to juggle. What we don't know is whether there's anything that's different about their brains when they're born, whether they have a special gift for mathematics rather than just putting in the hours in order to become very, very skilled at it.
Your argument that we are all hardwired to handle numbers, even if some of us are not prodigies, no matter how much time we spend on it, the argument doesn't seem to have the numbers behind it, though. In Australia, for instance, even in the most well-off communities with access to good schooling, about a third of people have poor numeracy skills, and in the least advantaged communities, it's two-thirds. And almost everyone is doing maths at school. So what's going wrong?
Lots of different things could be going wrong. It might be that teachers aren't teaching the kids in the way that the kids can learn optimally. mathematics education, I hope, is on a learning curve so that we can find ways of engaging children more than they've been engaged up to now. Though, in fact, quite a lot of attitude surveys among children and even adults suggest that, on the whole, the majority of kids actually like maths. They like maths because it's rather definite. You get correct answers or incorrect answers. It's rather satisfying in order to be able to go through some procedure and get it right. But for the very reasons that some people like it, other people don't like it because it means they get it wrong, and that's rather worrying. So that lowers their self-esteem, possibly, makes them anxious, makes them confused. So the same kinds of factors will have different effects on different kinds of personalities. So that's one reason. The other reason, I suspect, is because learning maths is a cumulative process, and if you miss out on some part of it, you might find yourself at sea when you return to it. So kids who miss some lessons through, say, illness might find it hard to catch up, whereas they might not find it quite so hard to catch up with, say, history, or they miss the history of New South Wales, but it doesn't affect them learning the history of Victoria. But with maths, if you miss a crucial stage, then it might be difficult to catch up. And that means that kids from disadvantaged backgrounds, who will be missing school a bit more than kids from advantaged backgrounds, they're going to have difficulty catching up. That's at least one possibility. Of course, all governments complain about the standard of maths in their country. In fact, if you look at international comparisons, Australia does very well. It does certainly significantly better than the UK in maths and science, and much better than the US.
Professor Butterworth, even with the best possible schooling, some people can't handle numbers, and it's a condition that you refer to in your work as dyscalculia. Now, how does that differ from just being bad at maths?
Dyscalculia differs from being bad at maths in several ways. One is you can be highly intelligent as well as having a good education and still be bad at, maybe not at maths overall, but at arithmetic, at calculation, and the way in which the curriculum here and in Australia is set up. You've got to be reasonably good at arithmetic in order to get on to the more abstract or imageable types of mathematics like geometry or topology. And so if you're bad at arithmetic, you might nevertheless be good at these other branches of mathematics. And in fact, one very distinguished dyscalculic that we've been testing, who's defence correspondent, written lots of books, been to university, actually taught at university, he managed to get what we call O-level mathematics, that's the 16-year-old mathematics level when he was going to school, because he was very good at geometry, even though he was absolutely terrible at arithmetic. He just managed to scrape in. If he hadn't scraped in, he wouldn't have been able to go to university.
What is it that makes dyscalculia different to simply not being very good at mathematics, or having been poorly schooled at it, or having missed a few lessons? Dyscalculics have real trouble with numbers, don't they?
Yeah, there are two things that differentiate dyscalculics. Usually, they've always been bad at maths right from the word go. Very often, they will have somebody else in the family who's bad at maths, though not always. Secondly, they don't respond to normal instruction very well. So the kid who's missed some classes and is falling behind, that kid can be brought up to speed with the appropriate additional help, whereas a dyscalculic, he won't be able to catch up. So the dyscalculic needs very specialised interventions, in the same way that dyslexics need specialised interventions to help them to learn to read. So those are the two main differences between dyscalculia and just being bad at maths.
The first person with dyscalculia that you came across, a woman called Kathy, how did she process numbers?
Well, she processed them really badly. So if you asked her what 9 plus 6 was, she would have great difficulty doing that. Yet she was able to program computers, she was able to run a small software business. But for her, it was really, really difficult. And we asked her to describe her mental picture of numbers. And that was really, really strange, because what she would do is she'd say, well, I have this mental picture, and I'll draw it out for you, of what the numbers look like. And she'd go, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that's, I know about those. And then I've got the next lot of numbers, which are 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Then I've got the next lot of numbers, which are 10, 11, 12, and so on up to 20. And then I've got the next lot, which is 20 to 30. So she was representing 5 twice in her mental picture, and she was representing 10 twice and 20 twice, so that when she tried to count through in the way that, say, an early learner would count through, she got things wrong because she was counting 5 twice, whereas we would only count 5 once. So she had a very, very abnormal mental representation. And when she left us, she was a little bit better, though, of course, not at normal levels for ordinary calculation.
What do we know about the causes of dyscalculia? Is it inherited?
We think it's inherited in a lot of cases. We don't know if it's inherited in all cases. We know it's inherited from twin studies, so if one identical twin has it, the other identical twin is very likely to have it. We also know that it persists into adulthood. There was a study done by Ruth Shalef in Tel Aviv, which showed that of the dyscalculics that she tested at age 11, most of them were dyscalculic at the age of 17, and almost all of them were still very poor at arithmetic. So it's heritable in many cases. It's something you're almost certainly born with, though it may not be heritable in some of those cases, and it persists. And we've been doing studies of lots of what we call high-functioning dyscalculics, who are dyscalculic even though they're very successful in their work, and they're very intelligent and have had all the advantages.
What is it that's happening in the brain of someone who has dyscalculia?
There are two things that we know about. We don't know an awful lot at this stage. One is there's an abnormality in the parietal lobes, and the parietal lobes are the critical areas for representing numerical magnitude in the brain. So knowing that fiveness is bigger than fourness, that's a parietal lobe function. And we know that there's abnormality in the critical little bit of the parietal lobe that represents number magnitude. Elizabeth Isaacs at the Institute of Child Health and her colleagues have found that there's less grey matter in that little bit of brain in her dyscalculics than there were in her control group. Another group in Stanford, led by Vinod Menon, have found that the connections between this part of the parietal lobe and other parts of the brain are different in dyscalculics. The other thing that's now known is that the activity in these areas is different in dyscalculics than in matched controls. So we think that both structure and functioning are different in dyscalculics. Now, of course, there's a problem about causal relationships here. So if you don't do much maths because you're dyscalculic, does that reduce the grey matter density in the relevant bit of brain? Does it change the way in which connectivity is set up? Does it change the pattern of activation? Or is it the other way round, that you start off with different grey matter density and this leads to dyscalculia? These are things that we're only now beginning to investigate, because only now have we got information about brain abnormalities in these dyscalculic learners.
You've designed a test for dyscalculia, which I understand is used in schools in Britain. Now, how does it work?
We wanted a test which, as far as possible, didn't depend upon your educational experiences. So if you have a standard arithmetic test, then if you've been to a good school, you're going to be better at it on the whole than if you've been to a bad school. So we wanted something that was very simple and something which targeted these simple functions in the parietal lobe. So the critical tests in our screener for dyscalculia is how quickly and accurately you can enumerate objects in a display, how quickly you can say there are 5 objects there, and how quickly and how accurately you can compare two numbers, how quickly you can say that 5 is bigger than 3. So it's a very, very simple test, and we find this is highly predictive of your ability to do arithmetic. It distinguishes between kids who are bad at arithmetic because they're dyscalculic and therefore will be bad on these enumeration and comparison tests from kids who are bad at arithmetic but are not bad on those two tests. And what we say in the screener notes is that if you're bad at arithmetic but good at enumeration and comparison, then you're not dyscalculic. There's another reason for why you're bad at arithmetic, and that the teacher or the educational psychologist then has to try and find out what it is that's gone wrong in your particular education.
Now, there would be a lot of people listening to this thinking, ah, that sounds like me, I'm dyscalculic. But you found that it's not very common.
It's about as common as dyslexia. So it's somewhere between 3% and 6%. Those are the best prevalence estimates that we have at the moment. So that means one child in each class is probably going to be dyscalculic on average. So it's actually a very serious problem. And if you look, for example, at the economic consequences of this, they're actually rather serious. If you could just get the bottom 10% of arithmetic learners up to the minimum level, minimum OECD level, which isn't very high, then you would increase GDP growth by quite a lot. So, for example, in England, if we could get the 10%, half of those will be dyscalculic, up to the minimum level, that would increase our GDP growth by 0.44%. Now, it doesn't sound very much, but if you know that GDP growth in the UK is, say, 2%, an additional 0.44 is actually a 25% increase in GDP growth. And although it's not quite the same for Australia, because their overall average is a bit better than ours, it is going to make you significantly richer if you could just get these dyscalculics up to a reasonable level. So I think one of the things that's really important going forward is to find effective ways of getting dyscalculics up to at least a reasonable level of competence at arithmetic. And that's one of the things that we're currently trying to do.
As well as the broader implications, there are also personal implications for people who have difficulty with maths, that problems with numeracy have been linked to difficulty getting a job, depression, higher health costs and so on. So with a condition like dyscalculia, you'd be wanting to catch it early. How early can you screen for it?
At the moment, we don't have a reliable screener for kids younger than six. When we understand the brain processes a bit better, we may be able to screen them earlier, in the same way that you can now screen for dyslexia really very early on. They're not definitive diagnoses, but what they do is they identify children who are at high risk of dyslexia, and I think we might be able to do the same for dyscalculia. I think one of the important things is for educational authorities, including governments, to recognise that dyscalculics need special help. It's been calculated in England that it would cost about £2,600 per child to bring the level of the lowest 10% up to a reasonable level for primary school kids. Now, you might think, oh, that's quite a lot of money per child, but it's also been calculated that the return on investment is between 12 and 19 times. That is, for every pound you put into this program, you, the government, will get £12 to £19 back, because you improve the employment prospects of these individuals, you improve their health status, you reduce the probability they're going to have trouble with the law. And it means that if their employment prospects are better, of course, it means they're spending more, you're getting more in taxes. So it actually would make an awful lot of sense for governments to really put the investment into helping those who are least able to do maths to do it a bit better.
You mentioned earlier that people who are diagnosed at an early age are still dyscalculic in their later teens and so on into adulthood. So it suggests that it is a lifelong disability. What kinds of interventions can you introduce?
We know it's lifelong for some people. We don't know if they would have still been dyscalculic if they'd had the appropriate intervention. We think that the way to help them is to strengthen what we call basic number concepts. So getting them to do plenty of practice with enumeration, with counting, with comparing numbers, and doing very simple addition and subtraction. So they have a feel for numbers, which the rest of us take for granted, but which they find very difficult to achieve. We're actually developing software so that the kids can practice a lot at these very, very basic tasks. We don't have a proper evaluation of this software yet, but we do know two things. One is that using software rather than teachers, or if you like, in addition to teachers, I think that would be a better way of putting it, kids do far more examples than they would if they were doing it just with a teacher. So with a teacher, you might be able to do two examples a minute. With software, you might be able to do 10 or 15 examples a minute. So you get much more practice using software. Secondly, teachers tell us that when the kids have been using the software, they're much more comfortable with numbers and they're much more keen on the math lessons than they were before. They seem to do better in classroom tests, but I think it's too early to say that this is generalizable, because we've been using just a few teachers in a few schools. So one of the things that we're keen to do is to make sure that this kind of software that strengthens basic number concepts is made widely available, so that we can do proper large-scale evaluations. And if we're right about this, then it means that there's hope in the future for people who suffer from this very serious handicap.
You mentioned earlier that dyscalculia seems to be a problem with what's happening in the parietal lobe. Have you been able to look at the interventions that you've designed and whether they are improving the activity in the parietal lobe?
We haven't done that yet, but we and other teams around the world are planning to look at that. It's been done for dyslexia, and we know that with the right kinds of intervention, patterns of activation in the relevant parts of the reading brain change. And one of the interesting things in the dyslexia literature is that the changes are towards making brain activity more normal. Now, it wasn't obvious that that was going to be the outcome. One possibility is that the dyslexic reading brain would find a different way of doing effective reading from the rest of us. But what they, in fact they found was that the dyslexic brain became more like a normal brain after the intervention. So one of the things that we're interested in with dyscalculia is whether intervention makes the dyscalculic brain more normal, or whether the intervention just helps the dyscalculic learner find a different way of doing the same task.
There's been quite a vigorous debate over the years about whether dyscalculia, the neurological difficulty with numbers and maths, is entirely distinct from dyslexia, a difficulty with words and language. Has that debate been settled?
I think it has, but other people don't agree with me about this. The problem is that kids who have dyslexia often have dyscalculia, and kids who have dyscalculia often have dyslexia, but not all of them do. So you find kids who are just dyscalculic and kids who are just dyslexic. And if you look at the parts of the brain that are involved in reading, they scarcely overlap at all with the parts of the brain that are involved in arithmetic. So that's one reason for thinking that they're distinct. We're beginning to understand better the kinds of genes that are involved in dyslexia, and they don't seem to be genes that are involved in dyscalculia. So again, at the genetic level, there seems to be a difference. But it might be that there's some common cause for both dyslexia and dyscalculia. So something which affects the way in which the brain develops might affect both the reading part of the brain and the arithmetic part of the brain. We don't know that yet, and that seems entirely possible. What I think to me is clear, but to many people in the dyslexia business is not clear, is that dyslexia doesn't cause dyscalculia. So the fact that you're not very good at reading, of course, is going to handicap you in lessons. You're going to have trouble learning arithmetic in the way that the other kids who are not dyslexic learn arithmetic. But in itself, it doesn't actually affect your ability to represent numbers in the brain. In fact, we did a study in which we looked at kids who had dyscalculia and kids who had both. And on the maths test, the kids who had both were no different from the kids who had just dyscalculia.
So, for example, an exercise like Susie has three oranges and she gives Jenny two of them is both an exercise in language as well as mathematics.
That's right. So dyslexics might be bad at that if they have to read it, but it doesn't mean that they have problems with the numbers. It's just they have problems here, in this case, with understanding the words.
Now, this brings us to one of the people that you studied, a man called Charles, who was both dyslexic and dyscalculic, and you looked at his neurological performance in both numeracy and literacy. What did you find?
Well, he was very severely dyscalculic. When we first tested him, he was 30, and he had a degree, so he managed to get to university. But he was still calculating by counting on his fingers. If you asked him to add 5 and 3, he would count them out on his fingers. But he was very good at counting on his fingers because he'd had a lot of practice. He'd had 25 years of practice counting on his fingers, and he would do it rather subtly. He would do it under the table, for example, so you didn't see him doing it. But if you asked him to multiply 5 by 3, he would do that on his fingers as well. So he would count out 5 on his left hand and then put up one finger, count out another 5 on his left hand and put up another finger, count out a third 5 on his left hand up to 15. He would then be holding up 3 fingers on his right hand. But if you asked him to do 6 times 3, he couldn't do it because, as he said, I don't have enough fingers. So he was still using these very, very counting-based practices where everybody else of his age, or every non-dyscalculic of his age, would know what 6 times 3 is just because they've learnt it or would be able to calculate it more readily. His reading, on the other hand, was, although dyslexic, it was reasonably effective, so he was able to get a degree in psychology, and he's now got a qualification in law. So his dyslexia hasn't held him back, but his dyscalculia certainly did hold him back for a long time.
Why is it that dyscalculia has been so slow to be recognised?
Well, it's sort of in the position today that dyslexia was about 20 years ago. I think people were much more willing to recognise a problem of learning to read as being important than learning arithmetic as being important. They hadn't quite cottoned on to the fact that really arithmetic is fundamental to being an effective employed citizen in a numerate society, whereas it was kind of clear you've got to be able to read. But even so, when I started research in the 70s on dyslexia, the first dyslexic I actually tested was somebody who had been diagnosed as educationally subnormal when she was at school. And she wasn't at all educationally subnormal as we would think of it today. She was extremely smart. She was at a top university in the UK doing quite a hard subject, but she was very, very dyslexic. But it wasn't recognised by her school at that time. And she was very lucky that her mother was a paediatrician and said, my daughter's not educationally subnormal, she just has trouble learning to read. In fact, when she went to another school, they found a way of teaching her to read, which meant that she read in an unusual way, but relatively effectively, not at her age and education level, but, you know, well enough in order to get a decent degree at university.
Are there moves afoot, do you think, to have it recognised?
There's a circular problem with recognition. In order to get it recognised by educational authorities, including government, you need to be able to have a way of reliably identifying it, and I think we've got that. You also need to have a way of reliably helping the kids who have that problem, and I think we're on the way to that. But until we've got those two elements in place, parents are not going to say, I want my child to be identified as having this particular problem and to get this kind of help for that problem. And without the parents getting active about it, governments aren't going to get active about it. And if you look at the history of dyslexia, it's because parents' groups, the parents of dyslexic individuals, were very vocal that governments recognised it. And in fact, the National Literacy Strategy, which was put in place by David Blunkett, was perhaps in part put in place because Blunkett himself had a dyslexic son. So what we need is for the current government in the UK and presumably in Australia as well to recognise that this is a problem where you can identify the individuals, you can help the individuals, and that actually it makes economic sense to put in place programs to identify and help dyscalculic learners.